From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The Center's series of discussions about secondary education in America has examined various issues, including the mission of the schools, questions about standards and testing, competency, accreditation, private and public education, effective teaching, and curriculum reform. In part six of this series, the conversation turns to the impact on secondary education of political and judicial activism, and questions about how America's video and computer revolutions might affect the schools. The speakers are Gilbert Sewell, Dennis Doyle, Donald Steadman, and Carl Dulcy. Gilbert Sewell was education editor at Newsweek magazine. He's a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's completing a book on educational reform. Dennis Doyle is director of education policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Donald Steadman is associate vice president for academic affairs at the University of North Carolina. Carl Dulcy is dean of the School of Education at North Carolina State University. Here is Gilbert Sewell.
What is the court going to do now and in the coming years, having watched its interventions of the 60s and 70s cause so much disruption? Where do the federal and state courts go from here?
Well, I'll hazard a guess that they're going to slow down and may even back up a bit, the courts, and I think it is a function of a major shift in American public opinion and the mood of policymakers generally, that the courts have gone about as far as they should. We now need a breathing space for a decade or so, and I think there will be restrictions of the scope of court activities, some further fleshing out of existing areas. And I think the period of judicial activism was traceable in part to a willingness on the part of the courts to act in this area, but also a sense of frustration among reformers who lost faith in the capacity of the political process to solve problems. So instead of going to state legislatures, the natural home for problem solving, they began to turn to the courts. And I think particularly of an example like school finance reform, which is less emotionally charged than some of the other issues, in which the body of group of reformers interested in that subject convinced themselves that there was no way to gain a remedy before legislative bodies. And they then developed an arcane and interesting set of legal theories, which the courts finally found themselves willing to rule upon. And in that sense, there was a kind of a symbiotic relationship between the reformers, the public interest law groups, certain law schools, liberal foundations like the Ford Foundation, and the courts themselves that were willing to be essentially drawn into these areas. And on the plus side, it meant that the reformers had been forced to design remedies, because the courts historically had said they couldn't enter these areas because there simply was no remedy that the court could design. So the reformers, in developing their legal strategies, had to in fact design remedies, which they did design successfully and which the court imposed. But I think even that stream of judicial activism is going to slow down significantly.
Now, part of this slowdown may take the form of courts seeking more diverse input before they make decisions. It seems to me that in a number of cases, at least I've paid attention to, especially in the handicap or special education area, there's been a tendency for the court to respond to a single proposed strategy rather than to look at the pros and cons of what was being advised, and then that got them into the ditch, because oftentimes the master that they appointed, for example, to monitor and enforce a consent agreement was often part of the advocacy group that started the litigation in the first place. And my guess is part of the slowdown will be not to zing off in some other direction, but to be more informed about decisions it makes and more thoughtful about strategies they'll use to put things in place.
Is there any hope for mixing youngsters by race in the public system?
Any hope for doing it?
Yes. What we've seen over the last generation is a desegregation by race and a resegregation by class. We've seen this in district after district across the land. It's very likely that racial separation will continue to be the case in American schooling.
Yeah, and I don't see any changes in approaches to doing anything about that. I think there's a re-exertion of the concept of magnet schools, for example, or a more frequent analysis of the distribution of children and a revision of transportation planning. I don't see anything new being applied to address that issue.
Well, then, has the intent of Brown versus Topeka failed?
Well, I think one of the answers, one way of answering it is yes and no, in the sense that it's very clear to me, at any rate, that that there has been significant progress in racial integration in the schools. Depends on where one wants to look. In rural areas, very typically in North Carolina, there's a significant amount of racial integration in the schools, which would not have been envisioned in the days of Brown. The problem areas seem to be those metropolitan areas which are becoming predominantly black. The chances for successful integration within the schools are very, very reduced, and that won't be corrected until such time as we have dispersal of population. So I think that it's a mixed picture. From one point of view, de jure segregation is no longer to be tolerated, and that was, we go down, back to Brown, we do find dispersal of blacks in formerly all-white suburban communities. As was pointed out earlier, the private sector, many aspects of the private sector become integrated, which did not exist previously. So I think it depends upon the specifics of the local area as to what the possibilities are. But I would not regard Brown by any means as being unsuccessful. As a matter of fact, I think it's quite successful in terms of what it attempted to achieve.
Yeah, I would certainly second that. And I think that once you control for social class, certainly historians of 20 or 30 years from now will look back and be able to say with some confidence that integration had become a fact of American life, worked successfully, that at least in terms of the opinion setters and the decision makers in contemporary American life, invidious racism was certainly on the run if it had not entirely disappeared, and that I think the future is reasonably bright. I remain very concerned about the fate of inner-city minority kids who are poor, typically from broken homes. That, I think, remains an almost intractable problem. I mean, I think some of the patterns we're seeing emerge in cities like Washington, D.C., which has lost about 150,000 people in the past decade, is a city now characterized by large concentrations of very poor people, principally racial minorities, and very generous concentrations of very prosperous people, and the third category is somewhat less prosperous, but essentially childless working couples who are on career paths which will produce greater income for them in the future. So it's a school district which is becoming blacker and poorer, while the middle class blacks are moving out even more rapidly than their middle class white counterparts to take advantage of good suburban schools, or are flocking to private schools.
Is sentiment particularly white middle class and professional sentiment running against black and Hispanic adolescents? Do we hear people claim that these kids are ineducable and a threat to the to civic stability?
I don't frequently hear the issue cast in racial terms. Most people don't have the nerve to talk that way, even if they feel that way, for starters. But and I really do think that the issue is one of social class. I don't think there's any antipathy on the part of most educated white Americans toward sharing schools or churches or clubs or any other activity with members of other racial groups, so long as they are confident that there will not be a social class clash. And it's not a matter of even upper and middle and working class, so much as it is a sense of shared attitudes and a kind of a commonly accepted set of standards about civility.
I agree. The problem becomes one of class tension, of individuals who are unwilling to send their children to schools where they might encounter class values, not only different from their own, but class values that they consider inferior to their own.
I wouldn't discount the possibility, although I wouldn't necessarily recommend it, of some schools in at the secondary level moving toward consciously and voluntarily and purposely moving toward racially identifiable secondary school systems in much the same way and for probably the same basis that you see traditionally black institutions of higher education in this country lately moving in this direction. In other words, becoming concerned as their enrollment of white students exceeds, say, 20%, whether or not the racial identity or the ethnic identity of that institution wouldn't be lost. And you begin to hear discussions about the importance of racially identifiable institutions of higher education. And while I haven't seen that at the secondary level, I wouldn't discount that as a possibility, and even in the context of private secondary education with racially identifiable secondary schools.
I'm not aware of any secondary black schools, although there may in fact be some in the private sector. There were, of course, a large number of racially identifiable college preparatory public schools, and according to Tom Sowell, that pattern came to an end with Brown versus Board of Education, the premier example being Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C., which has probably the greatest claim to fame of any high school in the country in terms of producing black leaders and black professionals. And when it was turned into a neighborhood school, according to Sowell, it lost its unique academic character and its metropolitan character and became just one more ordinary high school. So I guess I would be surprised if a movement asserts itself in terms of ethnic identity in high schools. But I can see an analog appearing, and that would be, say, fast-track academic high schools in central cities, which might themselves enroll a minority
yeah.
population. That's been a very bitter fight in Washington, D.C., and Vincent Reed, our former superintendent, essentially stepped down as superintendent because he lost that battle. His board would not let him establish fast-track academic school.
But he won the war.
We'll see. It looks more promising now than it did a year ago.
Why was there such opposition to that academic high school in D.C.?
I think the same set of fears that greeted the Coleman Report, a concern about elitism, about skimming, about exclusivity, a feeling that there would be large numbers of kids left behind or left out. And I think that's very much a part of the American character. So while I disagree with it, it seems to me to be understandable and even in some measure defensible. It's a legitimate concern and one that people do well to talk out and thrash out. I think if the court drifts away from some kind of absolute sense of color blindness, that we're in for some very, very serious trouble. I think, for instance, of the decision of Garrity in Boston, in which he is producing essentially a reverse RIF list, in which white teachers with seniority will be fired out of proportion to their numbers to protect the last hired, which is to say minority teachers. Now, I certainly understand Garrity's impulse, but I think the operational consequences of counting by race are very, very dangerous and potentially very, very damaging to our society. I think Brown versus Board of Education gave us a kind of a majestic victory in asserting that heretofore America society would be absolutely colorblind. But as we begin to sort out and identify groups by gender, ethnicity, accent, color, shape, size, it becomes a very dangerous course of action. The Garrity suit I mentioned will be before the Supreme Court, probably. The American Federation of Teachers intends to pursue it to the Supreme Court, and that may present the court with an opportunity to make some final assertions in this matter. And if they find, as I hope they do, that colorblindness should be the guide to American behavior, then I'm reasonably sanguine about the future course of legal action at the school level.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to Part 6 of the Center's series on American Secondary Education. The speakers in this portion of the discussion are Joseph Adelson, Gilbert Sewell, Donald Stedman, Carl Dulcy, and Dennis Doyle. Joseph Adelson is director of the Psychological Clinic at the University of Michigan. Gilbert Sewell is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's finishing a book on educational reform. He was education editor at Newsweek magazine. Donald Stedman is associate vice president for academic affairs at the University of North Carolina. Carl Dulcy is dean of the School of Education at North Carolina State University. And Dennis Doyle is director of education policies studies at the American Enterprise Institute. What about technology, the technological explosion, the microchip, I guess you call it, calculators, TV used in the schools? What kind of an impact has that had? Has it been a favorable one on the schools?
I think it will. I'm not sure how it will. What I'm concerned about is that we don't get into the same utopian illusions that we've had in the during the 60s and 70s when it came to technology. We really too much given to the idea of a technological fix. And I have a lot of questions as to whether we can anticipate how it's going to work. It may turn out to be a modest advance. I suspect it will be. It will sort of ease things. It'll be a sort of lubricant for learning. Whether it will produce a revolution, I don't know. It might, but I wouldn't bet a lot of money on it. I think a few years ago I tried to review sort of rather briefly and cursorily, in my own mind largely, the history of educational innovation. And I'm just amazed at the number of great leaps forward, which simply have forgotten some of these technological and some of these merely procedural or managerial or what have you, open classrooms, this, that, the other. Many of these simply just disappeared, were followed by other enthusiasms. And when you see the cover of Time magazine given over to the computer generation, sort of I reach for my grain of salt. Here we go again. But I don't know. It may very well be that it's hard to. It's hard to remain skeptical in the face of all of this expert wisdom, but I just would like to see just in which, how this is going to take place. There's no question that, kids learn very, very quickly, and they learn how to use hand calculators, which I can do, and they learn how to use a computer, which I faint at the sight of one, but they go like that and so on and so forth. And this obviously is going to make a big difference ultimately in certain aspects of learning. I don't think learning itself is going to be revolutionized, by the way, by these instruments. I think that one of the things that I think maybe I can mention is a bit tangential to what we've been talking about. I'm a little bit troubled about the fact that we really don't know very much as yet about some of the fundamental issues involved in the learning process. I've been working for some years on how children acquire political and sociological and historical concepts. And I'm just one of a handful of people, as far as I can tell, who's working in this area. And yet the stuff that we're doing, it would seem to me to be vital for learning how to teach youngsters how to grasp ideas in the humanities and social sciences. And there's an absolute vacuum of information on how to educate. And what's even more amazing is that if you recently I've been reading William James. If you look back to William James, he was puzzling over the same problem about 100 years ago. And we've made no essential advance in, you know, how to identify barriers to and encouragements, inducements to the acquisition of ideas. This sort of fundamental, you know, building stones of education. A lot of that stuff hasn't been done. And what I'm concerned about is that we get so so carried away by technology that we think it's going to do the job of, you know, of teaching for us, which is not going to do. You still have to put something into that computer. And we also think that it's going to somehow help us make an end run around, you know, the fundamental processes of learning and how that's acquired and cultivated and so on and so forth. We really know very little about learning. This is what amazes me as I sort of come as an outsider to that topic. We know very little about how children learn. We know a lot about, surprisingly enough, we know more about how infants learn than about how adolescents learn. It's another amazing fact. You know, we've learned a tremendous amount in the last 10 years about how a 6-month-old learns. We know nothing about how adolescents learn. Furthermore, there's very little interest in cultivating that direction of research.
And why so little interest?
It beats me. It really does. It's I really don't understand why. There have been efforts on the part of the you know, the educational bureaucracies, research bureaucracies. I was a consultant to NICHD a few years ago, and they said we have to have more research on adolescent education, and then NIE came and also wants it. But somehow, up till now, it's been very, very difficult to fire the imagination of researchers. I'm not quite sure why. I think adolescence is a very difficult era for many people. I think there's something about teenagers which gets everybody sort of nervous and,
yes.
and so on and so forth. But that's not much of an explanation, but it's the only way I can understand it. It's beginning to change, by the way. We are beginning to get a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot. We are, relatively speaking, seeing an increase in research on adolescence. But it is still, of all the life cycles, all periods of the life cycle, it is the least understood, and that's sort of amazing. We know more about infancy. We know an awful lot, by the way, about early childhood and latency period. We're getting to learn a lot about, you know, the elderly, but we know almost nothing about adolescents. We have a lot of writing, but very little hard knowledge. Yeah.
And we know even less about the so-called draft age
group. That's right.
I don't think Pac-Man is going to replace the teacher. You know, from where I said, I think what we're seeing is a miniaturization phenomenon, not necessarily technological advance. That may make word processors or whatever you want to call them more available and more affordable, but I'll start getting excited about that effect when I see some software changes, somebody learning how to program these things or to begin to work on the matter of what kinds of tools these really are if you want information transfer to take place and learning to take place. I think where it's more likely to take place first, if at all, is among the at-home adult education group, the older population that can make use of primetime PBS or closed, you know, cable or closed loop television systems, whether they're university-based public television programs or whatever, but they will simply be, I think, initially at least, packaging of what we already knew with some other device.
I have a little different feeling about the impact of micros. Intuitively, I feel that the impact is going to be very, very deep-seated. Now, I'm not saying it'll be a panacea, nor am I at all sure that instruction will be enhanced. There's something about micros that's quite different from other technological innovations. They're addictive. If you walk, as I have, in shopping centers, which appear to be dead, there's one place that's alive, all right, and that's the game room. If you watch children at home working with micros, they're turned on, and as are their parents. So I have a feeling we're dealing with a different kind of an impact. Whether or not it can be harnessed for instructional purposes in an effective way, I don't know, but I think we're dealing with a force that we're going to have to reckon with, much as I think we still have to reckon with the impact of television on our society, with its movement of people, as I see it, away from an analytical mode to an impressionistic mode, which I think is profoundly affecting the way our political future is unfolding and various other aspects. So my feeling is that it's a phenomenon, this micro stuff is a phenomenon that we should try very hard to understand and to control before it's unleashed more on society and the unintended impact is felt.
Yeah, I find myself in agreement with Carl on this. I think it's potentially very important. And I think in addition to moving from an analytic to an impressionistic mode, television moved us from an active to a passive mode. And I think we'll see in retrospect that television was a very deep trough in terms of American or Western intellectual life between radio and micros. And I think micros hold out the promise of a very active and interactive role for television in particular to play, which is generally, I think, basically very encouraging. It transforms the nature of the medium. And I think in terms of interactive television, using micros and multi-cable feeds and so on and so forth, we will have the capacity for some very significant improvements in testing and measurement through utilization of computer-assisted testing and measurement, and also some significant improvements in rote learning. And in my most optimistic moments, I even think there is some genuine capability to improve analytic reasoning, begin to use these systems more completely. I think we just got the tip of the iceberg showing right now.
From the National Humanities Center, this has been part 6 in a series of discussions about secondary education in America. The speakers were Dennis Doyle of the American Enterprise Institute, Carl Dolce, Dean of the School of Education at North Carolina State University, Joseph Adelson, Director of the Psychological Clinic at the University of Michigan, Gilbert Sewell, former education editor at Newsweek magazine and a scholar at the National Humanities Center, and Donald Stedman, Associate Vice President for Academic Affairs at the University of North Carolina. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me this week for part 6 of the Center's series on American secondary education. The panel will examine two issues: the impact on the schools of political and judicial activism, and the potential effects on secondary education in the United States of the video and computer revolutions. That's American Secondary Education, Part 6, this week from the National Humanities Center and Soundings.